and welcome to Literary Loitering here on the Geek Show Podcast Network. We are here once again to talk about sort of book-related and also artsy stuff, maybe.
Yeah.
We don't know. We don't think these things through in advance.
Well, it is kind of books and arts today because we have books about books and arts.
God, it's like we've gone full Inception.
Yes, I know. Very strange.
Next week we'll be talking about arts which are full of books.
Yes. Quick, spin it up.
I don't have one.
Well, just spin around on the spot then. If you fall over, if you fall over after a while, then we know we're not in a dream.
Oh no, Rob, I keep spinning. It's all a dream.
I'm getting dizzy. Can I stop now? Anyway, seriously though, if you didn't have a spinning top handy, what would you do?
Surely the fact that if you always have the spinning top in the dream,
yeah,
then just by the very fact you don't have a spinning top on you means it's not a dream.
True. True. Hang on, I don't follow. What?
Or what if you left the spinning top at home in the dream?
Yeah, that is a thing people do forget. And if you left it at home, then suddenly have it, then you know you're in the dream.
I think that this brings us on to the one big flaw of Inception, in that at no point Leonardo DiCaprio looked down to realise he wasn't wearing trousers.
Yeah. Yeah, there's that one. I think the other one was he never did the whole, where's my keys? Nobody in any movie ever goes, where's my keys? Where'd I put my keys? And then goes through the house raging about how they can't find their keys. And the keys are right there.
Right, I think we've figured out the even deeper conspiracy.
Yeah, it's key conspiracy.
Conspiracy. No.
No, no.
Let's talk about books. I'm yes. Andrew, that's Rob.
Hello.
And we have got news and stuff.
Yes.
Oh, I think first up we have to actually start with some sad news. That architect Zaha Hadid has passed away. He's, of course, one of the country's most famous architects.
Yeah.
Known for...
Didn't she become a dame?
Yes, yes, she was Dame Zaha Hadid.
Yeah.
It's most famous for building the Aquatic Centre for the 2012 Olympics.
Yes.
So for the very sort of curvy buildings. I think, you know, you've done pretty well when you can look at a building and go, oh yeah, that looks like a Zaha Hadid thing.
Yeah, it's pretty iconic. And she had a very, very distinctive style. I think Zaha Hadid represented something in particular, not just to the field of architecture, but just about England, the United Kingdom, Great Britain, whatever you want to call it, just about all of it in general. The fact that she was a dame, but she was actually from, was it Iraq or Iran?
Yeah, yeah, Iraq originally.
Iraq originally. And she's a dame, and she was world famous for her work, and very, very iconic. Really pushed British architecture in particular. And it's really nice to know that we live in a country right now. Hopefully that will continue. But we live in a country right now where somebody who is from another country can actually come here and make something of themselves and really push the boundaries of things and be accepted by everybody.
Yeah, well, I think that's kind of an intrinsic thing to British culture, isn't it? Just taking things from other countries and adopting them.
Yeah. I mean, look at curry.
Exactly.
Curry's a prime example. But I think with Zaha Hadid...
Like tea is a prime example. Like, the most quintessentially British thing is from India.
And China. I think it's mainly from China. I think...
yeah, but I thought Indian tea was, like, the standard builder's tea type stuff.
Yeah, it's just basically tea, I think, originates from China. I think it was taken to India, and then basically they had all the Indian plantations for tea after that. I don't think it's a natural thing. It's like chilies. Chilies aren't actually from Southeast Asia, they're from South America and Central America. But with all the traders, they took chilies across, and then all of a sudden chilies started growing in like India and places like that. But they're actually native to South America.
Who even knows anymore?
We don't care. We like chilies. They grow.
And tea.
And tea. Not chili tea, though.
No, that's an unholy combination that shouldn't exist.
Yeah, if they say, if somebody offers you spiced tea, just check. What spice? If it's cardamoms and cinnamon and...
Cardamoms.
Cardamoms. Yeah. Cardamoms.
Like tiny mums wearing cardigans.
Yes. How do you say it? Is it cardamom or cardamom?
I thought it was cardinum.
No, it's cardamom. M-O-M.
Oh, that can't be right.
It is.
No, it's not supposed to be actually called cardimom.
Card-a-bom, I think it is. Google
yes,
is your friend.
Cardamom. Oh my God, it is cardamom. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's really expensive as well. It's kind of ridiculously expensive, I think, because you can go to India and Bangladesh and Pakistan and places like that and buy like massive bags of it. And then you come to the UK and use tiny, tiny bag, £4. It's like saffron, right? All the chefs keep saying, yes, yes, don't buy these big bags of saffron because it's not the saffron. It's actually the kind of case outside of the saffron. You're like, yeah. Does it give me the same effect? Well, yeah, then why do I care?
I think that is another quintessentially British thing we've stumbled upon is huge markups on things.
Yes. Yes, VAT. Anyway, we're kind of getting off the beaten track there. Zaha Hadid has sadly passed away. Kind of a modern legend in architecture, I think.
Almost definitely.
If any of the listeners ever get a chance to check out any of her work, do it. It's really, really special.
Yeah, I actually have. I saw an exhibition of hers in a museum in Denmark.
All right.
Yeah, some really impressive stuff.
Cool. Fantastic.
I just wanted to throw it in so I look cultured.
Anyway, shall we move on?
Yeah, let's move on to a very interesting story I've got.
Okay.
Is archaeologists have found a bullet from a Colt pistol in the Arabian Desert. Or is it still called the Arabian Desert?
Sahara Desert?
Sahara, whatever. Basically, it's a bullet in a desert, which basically the archaeologists found it, and they think it comes from a Colt pistol. Oh, I found a place. It's Halat Amar on the Saudi Arabia-Jordan border.
Okay.
Which, if anyone is like way up on their knowledge, knows is where the train attack scene in Lawrence of Arabia took place. And they think that this bullet from the Colt pistol basically confirms that T.E. Lawrence was actually there because it is the type of gun he used and not something the natives would have had.
Yeah. Have they been able to date the bullet at all?
Well, I would assume so.
Because my main question here is that I know a little bit about the tribes, the desert tribes, the Bedouin and the other tribes, and they are armed to the teeth and go around shooting things. And they just roam. You know, they just go from place to place. So my main concern with this would be, I know it's the place where that train attack scene happened, but could it possibly have just been a random Bedouin at some point?
No,
just going
I think they've got to have like dated the bullet or something.
Yeah, that's why I was saying have they dated the bullet.
Yeah, like they kind of just, I'm sure they haven't just like picked up out of the ground and go, yep, this looks like a Colt bullet, boom, confirmed.
Yeah. Well, that's my only concern.
Yeah, no, they've probably run like a whole battery of tests on it to confirm it did come from around about then.
It'd be impressive if they did confirm it, though.
Yeah. And like, it's cool to know that that actually did properly happen.
Yeah.
So now T. Lawrence, apparently he was quite well known for telling tall tales.
Yeah, he was kind of a Baron Munchausen when you get right down to it. He was, I did a Baron Munchausen reference.
You did, well done.
Yeah.
I'm impressed.
He was kind of a Baron Munchausen when you get right down to it, though. Although I'm not sure any of his colleagues had that, you know, run really fast, hear things from far away, and the rest of the Baron Munchausen tribe. Although I do like that film.
Yeah.
Was it Terry Gilliam?
Yeah, it was Terry Gilliam. I really need to watch that again.
Because he had some of the old Python crew in there as well, didn't he? Just like he did with Time Bandits, he had a bunch of the Pythons
in
there.
I think he could very well have done.
I'm pretty sure I saw Eric Idle in there. And I think, what's his name? Michael Palin was in there as well.
No, definitely need to rewatch that. It's on Netflix, I think.
Is it?
Yeah. Pretty sure it was.
Ooh. I think I've got my movie for tonight then. Because I do like that film.
Yes, I haven't watched it. I think I was like a kid when I last watched it.
I remember the trailer for Baron Munchausen when they were going, yes, action, adventure, and ball, and just a picture of his face with a big toothy grin. And that was it. Anyway, we're on Lawrence of Arabia. Actually, there's a film you want to see on the big screen if you ever get a chance.
Oh, yeah. I can see that being very impressive on a big old screen.
Well, Rob won't watch it. Rob hasn't watched it yet, and he refuses to watch it until he can see it on a big screen.
That's, well, good luck to him then.
Yeah, I know. But then again, given what we're going to be doing with the Ark, we may.
Potential future plans.
Yeah. Lawrence of Arabia on the big screen could happen. I'd go see it. Lawrence of Arabia on the big screen.
Yeah, I would happily watch it.
Right. Okay, shall we move on?
Yes, we shall move on. To a different story. Is the Queen has a book now.
Does she?
She has approved a children's book about her 90th birthday.
You're going to have to explain this one.
No, I don't have to do anything. You're not the boss of me. But I will. So it's written by Italian author David Klee and illustrated by Kate Slater. And basically it tells the story of the Queen looking for different crowns on her 90th birthday. You had to make it disgusting, Rob.
No, it wasn't disgusting. I was laughing because I just had this mental image of the Queen with like these different crowns, and you know, like the teenage girl going on a date and trying on the different dresses. Yeah. You just got the Queen with the different crowns in the mirror going, no, not that one. No, not that one. No, not that one. No, no, that one makes me look fat. No. Too stylish. And that's what I was laughing at.
Which, to be fair, that basically seems what the book kind of is. Apparently she gets advice from like the rest of the royal household, so the royal greengrocer sends her a fruit hat. Which I disagree with the Queen. She says, very lovely and very delicious, but perhaps not very regal. No, Queen. There's nothing more regal than the fruit hat.
I'm sorry, but what was her name who wore the fruit hat?
Carmen something, wasn't it?
Yeah, Carmen Miranda. Carmen Miranda, that's it. Yeah. It's just the fruit hat has to come with maracas.
Yeah. Well, that would be the new royal scepter.
Just the Queen doing the maracas down through Buckingham Palace.
I'd be down for that.
Or, because they had that on the Dreamcast, didn't they? Samba de Amigo.
Yes. We must train a monkey to play the maracas in the royal household.
Yes. It's royalty. He's going to wear a sombrero and have maracas.
Good to admit. That was actually like one of the best re-releases for the Wii.
What, Samba de Amigo?
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Especially because like you could buy little plastic maracas to come with it.
Yeah, but I had the originals until someone stole them.
Yeah, but the originals cost like an arm and a leg.
Yeah, like 100 quid.
Yeah.
Yeah, I know. And then someone stole it and I hate that person.
As well you should.
I will break that person if I find them.
I would say beat them to death with maracas, but that might break the maracas and that would defeat the whole purpose.
Yes, it would. So, anyway, we kind of got off topic. What are the hats are going to be in the book? Crowns, not hats. Yes. Crowns.
Wow. The royal stables people give her a mini carousel to wear on her head. Which, again, if the Queen showed up with like a crown with a carousel running around the top, I think that would be a vast improvement on the regular crown.
It would, but now, for some reason, I've gone magic roundabout. I've got like a corgi as Dougal, and I've got Prince Philip as like Zebedee. Just bouncing around going, what ho, what ho.
Prosecution definitely trying to shove him back in the box.
Yes. You gotta stop my brain from doing this.
I can't, Rob. There's no human way to stop your crazy brain.
Anyway.
But anyway, spoiler alert, eventually she decides to wear a paper crown made by Prince George.
Oh, that's cute.
It is.
That's cute. Meanwhile, Prince Harry gives her a piece of paper with a joke on it.
And they all sit around the TV and argue.
Yeah, about whether the joke was funny or not. Because that Harry, he's a cracker.
I don't think you can be racist about the royal family, Rob.
I wasn't. You know, the Christmas crackers.
Yeah, I know.
Oh,
I was joking about the two meanings of the word cracker.
Oh, he went there. He got me.
I did got you. I got you good.
Okay. Anything else?
Not on this one, but we do have one more story, which is another book that's coming out, which is a book by Robert Boynton, whose title is called The Invitation Only Zone, The True Story of North Korea's Abduction Project.
Ooh, sounds serious.
Yeah, it's apparently basically something North Korea did in like the late 70s, early 80s, basically just straight up abducting people and putting them in what they call an invitation-only zone.
Okay.
And basically using them to like get information on other countries and train spies, which is kind of insane.
Yep.
And like a thing I can 100% believe North Korea did.
Yeah. North Korea is a kooky place filled with strange people with bad haircuts called Kim Jong-un.
Yeah. I think this was back in the time of Kim Il-sung, though.
Yeah. I always found it funny that Kim Il-sung went to Kim Jong-il. Now it's Kim Jong-un. But Kim Il-sung, everyone seems to have forgotten that Kim Il-sung was actually a person, because everyone just remembers the magnificence that was Kim Jong-il.
Yes, him and his benevolent glory.
I'm using the term magnificence sarcastically. Yes. You do know this.
I mean, I do.
He was the greatest sportsman ever.
He did. I believe he also invented the cheeseburger.
Yes, he did. You know, there was a double rainbow in the sky on the day he was born.
Kim Jong-il.
Okay, Kim Jong-il was... He might have been crazy. We don't know. We have all the signs.
Oh, no, we know. He was crazy. He was super crazy.
Yes, he was. But he was kind of... We treated him more like that crazy old uncle who pops over to visit every so often.
Yeah, I think this is like the problem with North Korea, is that they come up with stuff like, Kim Jong-il, he puts a hole in one on every golf course and invented the cheeseburger. And we go, oh, North Korea, yeah. You silly rapscallions.
But it's kind of changed since his son's taken charge. Kim Jong-un is just kind of... He's more like Edward Norton was during the early part of American History X.
Yeah, just insanely racist.
Insanely racist and will curb stomp you.
Because finally it's letting people realize that, oh, North Korea, you're actually kind of dangerous and scary.
Yeah, because as you said, everyone was like, oh, North Korea, ruffle the head. Yeah. You scamp, you.
Like, we know you're evil, but you're so silly, we can't condemn you.
Exactly. I mean, hell, James Bond had a movie.
Yes. Was...
And the North Koreans were like, yeah, fine.
Like, I'm pretty sure a good portion of the audience were convinced that North Korea probably is working on a... Actually, no, not even the North Korean government probably saw, we could use hovercrafts to get over South Korean minefields.
Yeah.
Get to work on that.
Yep. And now what we have is basically, we have games like Homefront the Revolution, where obviously it's the North Koreans who've taken over. There's Red Dawn.
North Korea invades all of America.
Yeah, I know. It's
all
weird.
All of it.
It's weird how that works.
At the same time.
It's strange how that works, isn't it?
Pretty sure it's mathematically impossible.
Yeah. I mean, I think that what they're doing is going, the Japanese invaded China and managed to do a lot of damage, commit a lot of war crimes at the same time, let's be honest. So, what North Korea, they have the potential, they could conquer America. It's a thing, because the Japanese invaded China, so
yeah,
we know it's
I
a
guess.
Thing. And like, well, yeah, okay. You do realize that eventually the Japanese couldn't hold on to China. They were kind of kicked out.
Yeah, and also... The Japanese weren't as hugely incompetent as North Korea are.
Yeah.
And China was not as militarily advanced as America is.
Yep. Try it now, folks. It's like, yay, North Korea, we're going to test solid fuel rockets for our missiles. America's going, got those like 50 years ago.
But no, we're doing it again. We're getting distracted by how silly North Korea is and forgetting that they're bad guys.
Yes.
So let's get darker again, because apparently, according to one of the parts of this book, basically the fugitive captured in Pyongyang also basically used to produce children who could potentially be used as spies.
Oh.
Which, yeah, that's why North Korea is a bad, bad place.
Yeah. I don't really know what to say to that.
Yeah, no, except North Korea is terrible and someone needs to do something about that at some point.
It'll get done at some point.
Oh, yeah, it's only a matter of time, I think, now.
Yeah. Problem is, they've got their hands full with the Middle East and everything that's going on with the Arab countries, so that's given a ripe opportunity for North Korea to flex its muscles. If the whole thing in Syria and the whole thing with Daesh or IS, whatever you want to call them, I refuse to call them Islamic State. I think that the press is actually doing a disservice by continuing to use the term the so-called Islamic State when politicians and lots of religious leaders have started using the term Daesh instead to refer to them. Because,
yeah, I like that basically distance them from the religion of Islam.
Yeah, but you watch the BBC or any other news service and they keep referring to them as the so-called Islamic State, and by not using the different terminology, they continue to perpetuate this idea that Islam is somehow associated with what they're doing when, hell, a whole bunch of Islamic religious leaders actually issued the death sentence against members of Daesh, said, this is not Islamic, and if you're a Muslim, then you need to fight against this. This is basically what they've said. They've issued a fatwa against Islamic State.
Yeah. Just like Salman Rushdie.
Yes.
Hey, it's funny again now. It's back to lighthearted hijinks.
I wouldn't call a fatwa against Salman Rushdie.
Yes, this is the point where we've got to. A fatwa against Salman Rushdie is as light as we can go.
Well, I can take it lighter. Because I was watching BBC this morning.
Yes. Yes, the final news story.
We can go lighter, because you're right, it is pretty dark.
Yeah, it's been a grim show so far.
Anyway, Simon Keegan, who writes for the Daily Mirror, has released a book called Pennine Dragon, and he reckons that he has evidence that King Arthur wasn't from Wales, Cornwall, that sort of area, and that Tintagel Castle, or the area around Tintagel, wasn't the base for Camelot, and he reckons he's got compelling evidence to prove that. According to Keegan, he's the greatest folk hero who ever lived. King Arthur is more famous than Robin Hood and William Tell, and he comes with a cast of characters like Lancelot and Merlin, but most people can't seem to agree on who he actually was. Early records, he was depicted as the savior of Britain after the Romans left, a man who was victorious in dozens of battles, but over the next 1500 years, he was variously cast as everything from a chivalrous king to a brutal warlord. And the current theory is that what we have as the modern version of King Arthur is actually several different kings combined into one.
Yeah, I've heard that.
But what he reckons is he's actually found the source for all of that, the original King Arthur, or rather, from his perspective, looking at Tintagel Castle, he was talking about it this morning. He says Tintagel Castle is actually too late for King Arthur. The castle was built much later on.
Yeah, so basically he's found who might be the original inspiration for King Arthur.
Well, not who, but more where. He's basically said that looking in Cornwall and Wales and Glastonbury and places like that for remains of Arthur was wrong in the first place, because Arthur was probably born around Catterick, and Camelot was probably around Huddersfield. There's a place near Huddersfield which has Arthur as part of its name, and that place originally, in Roman times, was called Camelud.
Which does sound an awful lot like Camelot.
But the thing is, the fact that it has Arthur in its name now.
Yeah, which I guess could have come from, or could have just been someone saying, who also found that, oh, this place used to be called Camelot. That sounds like Camelot. We should name this place after King Arthur.
Well, he's absolutely confident. He does identify Arthur. He does identify Arthur as a historical king. I forgot about this. Yeah, he does. He does. He's absolutely confident that Arthur can be identified with the ruler called Arthwis ap Mar. And he lived from 470 to 540 AD. and he was born at a settlement in what is now Catterick, and his father was also a king in the Yorkshire area. He thinks it is down to a misreading of ancient British geography. These days, we tend to think that the Celts were confined to Scotland, Wales and Cornwall, and that's where the King Arthur legends have grown strongest. However, it wasn't until the invasion of the Saxons that those divisions took place, and Arthur was a key military leader during those bloody battles. It just doesn't make sense for him to have been based in Cornwall.
Yeah, seems like a pretty solid theory that King Arthur could have been from Yorkshire.
Yeah. Well, I mean, there was a reason why York was the Roman capital for the country.
Because it's a very nice city.
Yeah, it's a very lovely city. Anyway, so that's the theory. We'll leave better minds than ours to debate that theory, but I'm pretty sure the Cornish Tourism Board isn't happy.
Oh, no, they will not be. Oh, my God. Well, my family were thinking of going down, like, Cornwall area-ish on holiday this year.
Yeah.
So I think I might have to find, like, some sort of King Arthur Museum in Cornwall and just go, so you guys know this is all wrong, right?
Well, that also, the whole thing about Glastonbury as well.
Oh, yeah, yeah, Glastonbury's cancelled now.
Glastonbury being Avalon and stuff like that, maybe not.
No. A muddy field is an Avalon. How could we have ever worked this out?
I'm just thinking about it, because the whole thing with the death of King Arthur, after it was at the Battle of Camlann, when Mordred was supposed to have killed him.
Maybe.
And then I think it's the Once a Future King is the bit that I'm referring to, where the three women are supposed to have taken Arthur's body in the boat to Avalon and...
Yeah, sailed off into the fogs of whatevers.
Yeah, and I was just thinking, if you look at the geography of southern England, right, because that water apparently wasn't there before, so that was basically a flood. And which part of England gets flooded the most?
It's only Flaming York. that's a fair point.
You know, the bad weather's kind of proved it.
Just King Arthur floating away on the ooze.
anyway, shall we take a break there?
We shall take a break
from that really dark news. Really dark. I left the news to Andrew today. He picked all the he picked all the dark stories.
I did. It's because I'm so emotionally damaged inside.
I didn't say that.
It's fine. We're edgy and cool now, Rob.
Yes, we are.
All the goth kids will listen to us.
No, not the goth kids.
Shush you. They're our target demographic now and you'll like it.
Fine. I'll get the copies of Twilight out.
No, it's not worth it.
Anyway, we'll be back in a moment.
Hello, and I'm Lewis from Keyframe, the geek show's coolest and most composed anime podcast. Just like an anime protagonist. No, we're crazy as heck, but watch us anyway. You'll like it. Trust me. That first bit was a lie.
Hi, everyone, and welcome back to Literary Loitering on the Geek Show Podcast Network. I didn't just forget that I was the one welcoming back there.
No, no, well, say you didn't, Rob.
Yes.
And no one will ever know the truth.
Yes. Anyway, we have got books to talk about now. So we're going to start off with...
books at the wazoo.
Yes, we're going to start off with Andrew, who's having an adventure.
Yes, because it is adventure time. I've been reading Adventure Time's The Enchiridion and Marcy's Super Secret Scrapbook.
Okay. Are they two books in one then?
Yes. You can kind of read through The Enchiridion that about a little over halfway through that stops, and you can sort of flip the book over, start reading from the back the other way around.
Ah.
And that's Marcy's Super Secret Scrapbook.
Okay.
But it's written by Martin Olsen and Olivia Olsen, who are actually part of the show's cast.
Are they?
Yeah, Olivia Olsen is Marceline the Vampire Queen.
Okay.
And what I think pretty cool is Martin Olsen, who is her dad, actually plays her dad on the show. Yeah, which is cool.
That's really good.
Her dad being Hunson Aberdeer, Lord of the Nightosphere.
Right, so You watch Adventure Time.
I do. I am an Adventure Time fan.
Okay, so tell me, what is the attraction to Adventure Time then?
I think it's basically the idea, it's basically taking a kid's show and seeing how unlike a kid's show it can be without breaking any of the broadcasting rules.
So kind of like Gravity Falls did as well?
Yeah, yeah. I think this was basically like the one that's really pushed these types of shows.
Yeah, because Gravity Falls is like the best horror cartoon ever made.
Yeah, I heard that. But yeah, Adventure Time is like a very similar thing of just absolutely pushing the envelope as far as it can go.
Cool.
And this, the Enchiridion, basically it's a thing that's been featured in the show. It's the Hero's Handbook. So this is a new version, conveniently compiled by Hudson Abadir.
Why conveniently?
Well, because it's written by Martin Olsen.
Yeah.
So within the story of the book, it's written by the character he plays.
Okay.
Well, so well compiled.
Okay.
So obviously it was written by the heroes of old.
Ah, okay.
And it basically goes through all the tips and tricks you need to be a totally righteous hero.
For example?
Well, for example, how to carve out a Cyclops' eye and turn it into a crystal ball.
Good tip to know.
Yep. And it's also, it's got a lot of fun sort of background information on things in the show. Like, I think my favourite bit is there's a list of weapons, and a lot of them are kind of swords that have been featured on the show.
Yeah.
And one of them is the sword that you see the Earl of Lemongrab wearing. And the Earl of Lemongrab, he is a character who basically has a lemon for a head. And all his lines are delivered in like this high-pitched shriek. And in this...
Are you sure it's not a war cry?
No, no, it is not a war cry.
Okay.
As I think anyone who is a fan of the show will know what I'm talking about. But this book reveals that the sword he has is actually a tuning fork that can turn high-pitched sound waves into sonic blasts.
Ah.
I think that's just like, that's a clever little in-reference.
Okay.
It was a nice thing to have expanded on.
Okay, okay, okay.
Also, you have a bestiary, and in that they have ancient psychic kind War Elephant, who is the best monster in Adventure Time.
Ancient?
Ancient psychic tandem War Elephant.
I'm not following ancient psychic tandem War Elephant.
Basically, he is a floating elephant with a head on each end, who is like outfitted in lots and lots of guns, and is also psychic and very old.
A head on each end?
Yes.
Kind of like the Push Me Pull You from...
Exactly like the Push Me Pull You.
Right, okay.
But with much more guns for trunks.
And an elephant.
Yes. And also psychic and okay. Ancient.
Yeah, I got the psychic and ancient part. I'm just trying to follow the rest of it. Where do the guns come in?
Because he's a war elephant, Rob.
So is he like one of those giant robots from anime where the guns just come out of compartments, or is he just covered in guns?
No, he's basically just like covered in guns.
Right.
Like, I think
okay.
He has basically like shotguns for Trunks.
Okay, now I'm getting confused again. Trunk
yeah,
as in elephant trunk, or Trunk as in swimming trunks, or Trunks as in Dragon Ball trunks?
Yes, he has two like massive versions of Trunks from Dragon Ball just sticking out the side of his face.
And they use the shotguns.
Because they're from the future.
Okay.
No, right. No, but I mean, like his elephant trunks, the pointy stubby bits, they are shotguns instead.
So his trunk is normal, but the actual tusk, then?
Yeah, tusk I meant.
Right, okay. Now
this is where I've got... I meant tusk, not trunk. This is where the confusion has come in.
Yes, this is where the confusion has come in.
But I'm pretty sure he can also fire laser beams from his trunk.
Now I'm confused again.
But this is why I like Adventure Time, because it's just crazy random.
So what else is in the bestiary then? I'm curious as to the other creatures in the bestiary.
Oh, I'm going to have to look it up. I got slightly distracted by ancient psychic tandem war elephant who nearly knocked over my glass but didn't. Everything is fine.
You meant to do that in the style of Lego Batman.
We have the Epic Beast.
Okay, what's the Epic Beast?
He's a beast what is epic.
Okay.
He's basically just like a giant hairy monster thing. Then we have Tiny Bucket Night Monster.
Okay.
Basically, he's got like a bucket, and that's his main thing. It's that he's very small and carries a bucket about.
Okay.
he's not the scariest of monsters.
He doesn't sound it.
Then we have Dimple Plant Monster, which is actually one of the scariest monsters.
Really?
Yeah, it's basically like, it's a plant that sticks out the ground, but underneath is a giant worm monster.
Okay.
With a mouth full of fangs.
I can understand why that would be scary.
We have Distrilag, which is this thing from the Nitosphere, which is, it's hard to explain what it is. It's basically half a face on legs.
I'm going to have to see this.
Yeah, I'm going to pass over the book to you.
I didn't destroy the book.
Lies, you did destroy the book.
Indeed. Oh, it's got the ancient psychic tandem war elephant there.
Told you I had the ancient psychic tandem war elephant.
And the grass bear, which looks like some kind of strange caterpillar.
Yeah, I think it's like basically a caterpillar mole rat.
Okay. Okay, so is that all the Enchiridion?
Oh, no, it's much more than that. Because basically running through this, and especially in the second part, which is a guide for wizards,
yeah,
the Enchiridion itself becomes more and more sentient. So, like, especially in the wizard bits, it's because it's a book for wizards, so it's very pretentious.
Yeah.
But then, basically, the text will change to just the Enchiridion saying, God, this stuff is really pretentious, isn't it? And eventually, that leads to it directly talking to the reader and revealing that the reader is actually an ancient being.
Okay.
And in millions and billions of years at the end of the multiverse, when the ancient god who has dreamed all of us into existence finally wakes up, they have to make a decision. Do they decide to recreate the multiverse as it was or start something new? Yeah, it gets surprisingly like metaphysical and philosophical towards the end.
Okay.
Which is like, that is Adventure Time through and through.
Sounds it. And I've heard things about Adventure Time. I've never actually been a fan, I'll be honest. But I've heard things like Adventure Time was set after like an apocalyptic war.
Which actually is interesting because I'm going to get to that in a minute. I think one last thing I want to say about the Enchiridion, which I like as well.
Yeah.
Is the flow a bit sort of like a margin where they'll have characters from Adventure Time talking to each other.
Okay.
Which I think it's a nice little extra. So you've got Finn, Jake, and Marceline, and the Ice King. And Lemon Grab pops up for one thing just to yell out, unacceptable!
Okay.
Because that's like his catchphrase.
Unacceptable.
Yes. Except screamed in like the top of your lungs in the highest pitch imaginable.
Okay.
Yeah, that's the Enchiridion. And then we get to Marcy's super secret scrapbook, which is actually super dark. Because, as you said, Adventure Time is actually set in basically a post-apocalyptic Earth.
Yeah.
After, basically it is that nuclear bombs went off, destroying all life on Earth, and new life is sort of mutated.
Yeah.
To make the creatures of Adventure Time. But Marceline is actually a survivor of the old world. So this basically documents her entire childhood.
Okay.
So we start off with, it's not actually her diary to begin with. It's the diary of Simon Petrikov, who is a man who eventually becomes the Ice King.
Yeah.
And he has, like, this amazingly tragic backstory. Basically, he finds a crown that gives him control over ice and uses that to survive the nuclear apocalypse.
Yeah.
Basically, meets Marceline, decides to take care of her because she's only a child. But every time he puts the crown on, he loses a bit more of his mind.
Wow.
And basically, the diary is just this slow descent into madness.
It's pretty dark.
Yeah. It's like, it's something they've touched on the show, and it's just, like, it throws everything in a whole new light. Because the Ice King, who before was, like, this slightly wacky, oh, he's so weird and an oddball, it's like, oh, no. He's actually a guy suffering through something which is obviously a stand-in for dementia.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's pretty dark.
So eventually the crown begins to take its toll and Simon basically says, I'm sorry, Marceline, it's getting to the point where I can't look after you anymore because one day I'm probably going to hurt you by accident. So he just decides to leave. And from then on, it's Marceline basically trying to look after herself for a while until she discovers she can summon her dad. Hooray! But as I said, her dad is Lord of the Nitosphere.
Yeah.
Which is the Adventure Time equivalent of hell.
Yeah.
And her dad is basically Satan. So she summons him, and he straight up murders two of her friends.
Ugh.
Yeah. Like, he literally sucks the life out of them. And this is why Adventure Time is not really a children's show in the slightest.
Okay, I didn't know anything about this.
Oh yeah, God, Adventure Time can get super dark. Like, then there's a whole bit of Marceline, because she tries to justify what he did. It was just like, well, maybe he's like an animal just acting on instinct. And like, I hate what he's done, but he's my dad and I can't hate him.
Yeah, that old quandary.
Yeah.
I think I might have to sit down and watch Adventure Time, because I honestly didn't know anything about that. I knew about the nuclear apocalypse.
Oh, yeah, I mean, I think...
And that's pretty much all I knew.
This sort of stuff starts coming in, I think, maybe like towards the back end of the first series.
Okay.
So I think the first like big episode is one called Holly Jolly Secrets.
Yeah.
And that's when you first learn about the Ice King actually being this guy who's, you know, like gone through basically dementia.
Wow. Yeah, I think I'm going to have to give Adventure Time another try.
Yeah, yeah, no, Adventure Time is not like the fun, happy experience it makes itself out to be.
I think that's the thing that threw me with it, because it looks, and the fans don't really sell it well.
No, I think that's the problem with fans in general.
Yeah, they don't really sell it.
It's like, oh my God, Adventure Time's so amazing, it's so good, you should watch it now.
That's literally all I've been getting. Yeah. You know, you've actually sat there and explained things, and I'm like, well, actually, that sounds pretty interesting. Sounds like the kind of thing that I'd be into. But when I talk to other fans of Adventure Time, they're like, oh, it's so amazing, the story, the writing is great, the characters are great. And I'm like, well, yeah, but what's it about? And they just go, oh, you need to watch it, you'll understand it straight away. No, I want to know what it's about. Tell me what it's about. But.
Yeah, this is the classic fan problem.
So, yeah. Anyway, so, that's available now, isn't it?
Yeah, that is available right now.
From, who's it? Who's
from it? Titan Books.
Oh, fantastic. Right, so, moving on to me then.
Yes, I mean, I'm not even going to talk about the time when Finn got his arm chopped off and became depressed. Like, and I mean, like, properly suffered through clinical depression on a children's TV show.
Wow. Okay, I'm definitely going to have to give Adventure Time another try. Anyway, moving on to me then. And I have something a bit more, I'm not sure how to describe this, except for deductive reasoning was applied. There is logic to it.
That's a painful reference.
Yes, there's a logic to it. All I could say is Elementary, my dear Andrew. This is the Sherlock Holmes book from Darling Kindersley, and it's priced at $16.99. And now, if you're a Holmes fan, okay, let's start off with this. Everything that you could possibly want to know about Arthur Conan Doyle and Sherlock Holmes, you'll probably find on the internet, right? Which immediately it makes you think, well, isn't this kind of book redundant then? Well, it is and it isn't, because it's the kind of thing that if somebody's in school, for example, and they need a reference book for Sherlock Holmes, this is actually kind of ideal for that sort of thing. It's the kind of thing that you could have on a school bookshelf, for example, as a reference book for Sherlock Holmes. Same with Shakespeare, and I'll be talking about the Shakespeare one next week. But it's the kind of thing where it's kind of like the... you remember the kind of revision notes, the books about revision notes that you used to be able to get for A-levels and GCSEs and stuff like that? I don't know if they still do them, but...
Yeah, I think they used to do them when I was in school.
I think it was a company
called... God, I hope this is less dry than those.
I think it was a company called Letts that did most of them. This is kind of like the Letts notes of Sherlock Holmes. It is a little bit easier to read than the Letts notes. It's nowhere near as dry, and they've got a lot of pictures and stuff like that. And they basically go through, they start off with like an introduction to Conan Doyle, Sir Arthur Conan Doyle, and who he was, what he was, what he believed in, that sort of thing. And then they move into a brief overview. It's only a few pages long for each book. I'm talking like six, seven, eight pages at most. And they go through all of the Sherlock Holmes books. They also have timelines. They try and match things up to the other books. So they try and at least create some kind of Sherlock Holmes chronology. Unfortunately, it doesn't quite work, because I don't think anyone can create a Sherlock Holmes chronology.
Yeah, probably Because I doubt Arthur Conan Doyle really had one in mind when he was writing them.
Yep. Anyway, it goes on from there. It goes on from the books to actually talking about things like the art of deduction. And it goes into the history of deduction and deductive reasoning, you know, starting with like the ancient philosophers and stuff like that. And then it moves on to the cultural impact of Sherlock Holmes, the kind of things, you know, the kind of stories that have been inspired by Holmes and Watson. And then there's the all of the TV shows, all of the movies, because there have been more than two movies about Sherlock Holmes. I think The Hound of the Baskervilles was a movie, wasn't it?
Yeah, it's been umpteen Sherlock Holmes movies.
Exactly, and they go through all of that, and when you get right down to it, Sherlock Holmes is probably the most influential detective of all time. Because everything, I mean, there's so many detective stories now that take their cues from Sherlock Holmes. I mean, this even talks about forensics, and Holmes was kind of, you know, the character
was like
of Holmes
the precursor to
forensic. Modern forensics.
Yeah.
He was kind of the precursor to modern forensics, and it even talks about, you know, the influence of Holmes on the field of forensics. You know, how Arthur Conan Doyle wrote certain things in certain books that have actually been proven true by modern forensics and are actually used by modern forensics. But Arthur Conan Doyle wrote them as part of Holmes' character and part of his deductive reasoning.
Yeah. It makes it all the weirder that he completely misuses the term deductive reasoning.
Yeah, I know.
It's not, it's abductive reasoning.
Yes.
This is what QI has taught me.
Yes. Yes, it is. So, yeah. And then finally, it goes on to Holmes by Other Hands.
Oh. So, yes. All the other stories and films and what such.
Yeah. So, things like The Exploits of Sherlock Holmes and Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper, which was actually from 1966 by Ellery Queen and Paul Fairman. Which would have been an interesting one. Holmes versus Jack the Ripper.
Oh, Sherlock Holmes versus Jack the Ripper versus Spring-Heeled Jack.
Yes.
Because, we're talking about Victorian literature. I've got to work in Spring-Heeled Jack somewhere.
Yeah. I mean, they've got a whole bunch of them from, like, the 60s, 70s, and 80s. There's The Further Adventures of Sherlock Holmes, The Peerless Peer, The Return of Moriarty, The 7% Solution, The Giant Rat of Sumatra, Exit Sherlock Holmes, The Last Sherlock Holmes Story, The Holmes Dracula File, The 10 Years Beyond Baker Street, The Beekeeper's Apprentice, The Mandala of Sherlock Holmes, The Final Solution, Patient's Eyes, The Dark Beginnings of Sherlock Holmes.
Whoa. There's a Sherlock Holmes book called The Final Solution.
Yes. Yes, I know. There's some interesting things like The House of Silk, The Breath of God, and then there's this very, very interesting one, which I found, from 2009, called Dust and Shadow, An Account of the Ripper Killings by Dr. John Watson.
Yeah.
And that one's written by Lindsay Fair. And
that could be interesting.
That one's one that caught my attention because I thought, hang on, it's Dr. John Watson, and, okay, he's an MD, so I read the title and I read the blurb on it, and for me, it was like, this is Quincy.
Basically.
So yeah, there's loads of these. Sherlock Holmes, The Gods of War, Professor Moriarty, The Hound of the D'Urbervilles by Kim Newman.
Oh yeah, I think he's got like a whole series where like Professor Moriarty is the protagonist.
Yeah. And then there's other works of Arthur Conan Doyle, like The Mystery of Cloomber, Mika Clare, White Company, The Refugees, The Parasite, The Stark Munro Letters, The Lost World. Everyone seems to forget that Arthur Conan Doyle wrote The Lost World.
Yes, he did.
In terms of reference books, it's actually a pretty solid, pretty well put together and pretty decent reference book, I'd say. The question, again, comes down to, is it necessary? Because of things like the internet. And everybody seems to have a tablet PC these days. And to be honest, I think it kind of is, maybe not for the price. I think maybe it's a little expensive. I think maybe if it was like 12 quid, 13 quid, that would be more what people would pay. But as a reference book, I think it's fine. I think it's one of those things where, because at the end of the day, I'm one of those people who, if I ever have kids, I wouldn't want them to check everything up using the internet. I would want them to actually hit the books. Not hit them physically, but you know
what I
mean.
Read them.
Yeah, to actually read the books, to actually understand that reading is a thing and not simply going, yeah, I'm on Wikipedia, so control F, let's search for this keyword and let's just do this section of it here. Actually read through the book and understand it, you know, research it properly, because that's what a lot of people are doing these days. They'll go onto a Wikipedia article and go, right, so I'm looking for this specifically, and they'll do a keyword search and find that specific term and then just read that bit.
Okay, yeah, see, now I finally get that. Because a lot of the time people say, like, oh, I don't want my kids just looking at stuff on the internet, and, like, I kind of haven't really got what they meant.
Yeah.
Because I think because I've grown up looking up stuff in books, when I look stuff up online, I'll go, okay, here's a Wikipedia article on it. Now let's read the entire article.
Yeah, I read the entire article.
And then do some background reading.
Yeah, I read the entire article. But what a lot of people these days do is just do a keyword search for the section of the article that relates to what they're looking for. But when you only have that, and this is one of the reasons why when it comes to the kind of research part of education, people are actually starting to lose skills rather than gain them. It might seem on the surface that they're getting better at research and stuff, but what they're researching is such, it's sometimes completely out of context.
Yeah, it's like they'll have answers to very specific questions, but no wider knowledge of, like, their subject.
Exactly. And that's why I think books like this are important. I think it's important to keep having books like this. I don't think that the internet is the be-all and end-all when it comes to reference material. So, yeah, it's a great book, as I said, to have, it would be a great book to have on, like, a school library shelf or something like that, somewhere where it's actually going to be used.
Yeah, I mean, I used to love a lot of the superhero ones DK did.
Yeah.
I think I got, like, the X-Men one, the Fantastic Four one, Spider-Man one. Got a massive Star Wars one as well.
Yeah. I mean, we've got a bunch of the DK ones on the shelf there. There's the 75 years of Marvel Comics covers on the top shelf there, and we've got the Marvel Encyclopedia and various other things, and they're great as reference material, and we've used them as reference material because there's been times when we've wanted to check stuff up.
And just, they're fun to read through.
Yeah, exactly. And while this isn't as fun to read through as the superhero stuff, it is a good reference book.
Yeah. And actually, say as a kid, like literally last Christmas, I got a massive Marvel one.
Yeah.
Freaking loved it. It's like, it's the entire history of Marvel Comics.
Okay.
Do you know, at one point in the 1950s, Captain America fought Red Skull in hell?
Yeah.
I didn't, and now I do know that.
Yeah, I'm just wondering if it's the one we've got over there.
Could very well be the same one.
We will check on this afterwards. We shall. But anyway, yes, that was the Sherlock Holmes book from Dolan Kindersley and the
Adventure Time, Enchiridion and Marcy's Super Secret Scrapbook from Titan Books.
Yes, how much is that one?
It's money. Prices, $19.99.
Worth it?
Yeah, I'd say so, because like, it's pretty much two for the price of, well, not two for the price of one, but two within one.
Yeah.
And it's a lot more than just a reference book. It's kind of got its own story to it. Especially if you like the show and want to know more of the background.
Yeah.
Because this is the kind of stuff that like you don't really hear that much about on the show.
Cool.
Like, you get the entire origin story of Marcy's dog, Schwabble.
Okay.
And if that's not enough to convince you to buy it, I don't know what is.
Okay. Right. So, we're at the end of the show then.
We are at the end of the show.
Two interesting books, one of them more interesting than the other one, but the other one's a better reference book, I think. Right, so if you've enjoyed this show, dark as it was with the news, Andrew.
I'm sorry. No, I'm not. I'm never sorry.
So if you've enjoyed this show, then please remember the Geek Show Podcast Network is a voluntary organization, and in order to keep making all of this great content and more, we do need everyone's support, so please make a donation using the button on the right-hand side of our website or by purchasing one of our lovely bits of merchandise from the shop, which is on our website, thegeekshow.co.uk. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do so, studio@thegeekshow.co.uk, and all of our shows are available on Mixcloud and soon iTunes, Stitcher, and we are populating YouTube as we speak. So, yeah. Anyway, I have been Rob.
And I've been Andrew.
We'll see you all next week with more books, and there'll be bookish books next week.
Booky books?
Yes, booky books, because I believe you have Cthulhu.
In theory, I have Cthulhu next week.
In theory.
I should probably actually read Cthulhu first.
Yes, and I have Powers.
Which is a book with words.
Yes, it is.
And doesn't even have pictures.
Yes.
Wow, we're so professional.
Yes, we are. Anyway, we're going to leave you now.
And thanks for listening.